Thank you all for tuning into this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you'd like to find out more about this project, you can go to the podcast website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know about this project can be found at that site. Contact information, social media links, Patreon page, one-time donation page. Everything is there. And if you would like to support the work that I'm doing with this podcast, with this project, please consider going to the Last Born in the Wilderness Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness, and you can donate a very small amount of money per month to the production of this podcast. And by doing that, you can gain early access to the content of these episodes a week in advance. Our guest for this episode, Derek Jensen, is an environmentalist, activist, and author of well over a dozen books, including Endgame Parts 1 and 2, The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, The Myth of Human Supremacy, as well as countless articles and essays that address a more radical understanding of human civilization and its impact on the living planet we all share. Derek is the host of the radio show Resistance Radio, a show that is released weekly on Derek's website, derekjensen.org, as well as on the Deep Green Resistance YouTube page. I'll provide links to Derek's website, as well as a link to the YouTube page in the description of this episode. This is my second conversation, my second interview with Derek Jensen. The first one I had was last year. I think it was in maybe July or possibly August. And I really enjoyed that conversation. In that one, we talked about his book that he had just released not long before the interview called The Myth of Human Supremacy, in which we get into some of the themes that run through his book. And I really recommend that people check that book out. You know, Derek is just very prolific, and he's always working on some new project, and he's always expanding himself in different directions. This book that we talk about in this episode is called Bright Green Lies, and this actually hasn't even been released yet. He and his other collaborators that are working on this book, they've been working on this for some time, and I think they say that they plan on finishing it by the end of this year and having it released by next year. But I wanted to talk to Derek about the themes of this book because, one, I was just excited to have another conversation with him. But in passing, at the end of the last episode we did together, he was mentioning some of his future projects, and one of them he mentioned was this book, Bright Green Lies, which is an expose on so-called sustainable energy, renewable energy, green energy, you know, and that includes solar panels, that includes wind energy, biofuels. You know, there's this whole industry that has sprung up in the past few decades that is claiming to be able to replace the dirty fuel sources that we've been using for so long. That includes coal, you know, crude, you know, oil, the whole thing, right? And that this is a paradigm shift and that we're going to be able to transition quite easily into a new paradigm where we have clean energy, and we can continue to go on as if everything is fine. What this book attempts to go over and what Derek goes over in this episode is that there's a lot of myths, a lot of misconceptions and deceptions that have been cultivated by this industry and also environmental groups. And that's the thing that we also discuss, is that it's not just these industry representatives that are talking about renewable energy in this way, but also the environmental movement, the movement that is trying to, of course, give people some understanding as to what our technologies and our fuel sources are doing to this planet. But what's happened is that the movement has been co-opted by these industrialists, basically people who are trying to promote this narrative and this idea that if we were just to get off of fossil fuels and move over to electric cars, move over to, you know, solar panels, and that everybody could just somehow magically, without really much effort, move over to an entirely new energy system, and that everything will be fine, that we won't have to use fossil fuels anymore, or that we can reduce them down to zero, we can be carbon neutral or in carbon negative, where we're actually, I guess, removing carbon from the atmosphere somehow. This whole narrative is false. And as Derek goes over in this episode, he gives examples from his upcoming book about why that's false. How renewable energy, in fact, really isn't displacing the fossil fuel industry in any real significant way. And that the amount of resource extraction that is necessary in order to build solar panels and wind turbines and hydroelectric whatever facilities, this whole thing has to be built using precious minerals. And oftentimes, you know, there's intensive labor and exploitation of the planet, exploitation of the environment in order to achieve this. So the so-called clean energy that is being pushed as some sort of a solution is in fact kind of a lie. It's a bright green lie, right? So Derek addresses this in this episode. And I really enjoy this conversation, as I always do when I get into these topics. Derek has been working at this type of stuff for, he's been doing this kind of work for years. And what he is trying to really illustrate is that don't let the story, do not let the environmental, the environmentalist philosophy, the environmental activism that has been going on for decades get hijacked by this industry that only serves the interest of capitalists and capitalism, right? This system that is ultimately exploiting labor, exploiting human life, and exploiting all other life on this planet in order to continue to exist. And we have reached the end of the road. This cannot continue on for too much longer before the whole thing just begins to implode on itself. And we're already starting to see that. So I thank Derek for his wonderful insights and for working on this project to bring these truths to light. I wish I could give you a link to the book, but it has yet to be released. I'm sure that when it comes out, I'll maybe have another interview with him and we could talk about it then. But for now, I just want to get this message out there so that people can actually focus their energies on projects that are actually going to yield the kind of results that we really need at this time. So once again, thank you, Derek, for your time, and thank you all for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Derek Jensen. Have a wonderful week. Thank you. All right, Derek, thank you for taking the call and for doing this again. I really enjoyed the last conversation that we had it wasn't quite a year ago, but it was last year. And at the end of that conversation, you were mentioning in passing some of the future projects that you had lined up. And I think you actually, one of them was a children's book, a collection of stories that you released, which, that came out recently. But another project that is yet to, or another book that is yet to come out was, Bright Green Lies. And you were mentioning that it's in collaboration with a few other people, and what you're doing is you're trying to expose the underlying lies, deceptions, myths that people have about sustainable energy, green energy, renewable energies, whatever name it's given. And that essentially what you're trying to expose is that, you know, there's this idea that it's going to completely, replace fossil fuel in the fossil fuel industry, and that we're well on track to, you know, getting rid of this, these really toxic, polluting, fuel sources, and that we're gonna, you know, have a bright green future where we're gonna have solar panels on every roof, and, you know, we're gonna be able to have wind energy and all this stuff, and that it's not, and that it's gonna be much better and much cleaner, than what we've had up to this point. And what I understand is that, like you had mentioned, there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of deceit surrounding that narrative, that story. So if you could get into that a bit, you know, what are some of the, I guess maybe to start at a baseline here, when you talk about renewable energies, green energies, renewable energies, what exactly are we talking about? And not only that, what are some of the underlying assumptions that come with that discussion and your critique of that, of those assumptions?
Well, first, thank you for having me back, and I enjoyed our conversation before too. And
thank you.
So far as the bright green lies, there has been a transformation in the environmental community over the past few decades. At one point, the environmental movement was primarily about saving wild places and saving wild beings. And it was protecting wilderness, protecting the natural world from this culture. And there has been a transformation in the environmental movement, so that today environmental movement is primarily about, especially the sort of mainstream, I'm not talking about grassroots environmentalists, but the larger scale environmental movement is in many ways about sustaining this culture, sustaining the exact culture that is killing the planet. And they will often say this quite explicitly. And this is you see this all the time, especially in climate activists who will say very explicitly that what they're attempting to save from global warming is not the planet, but this culture. And you will see, the former head of Greenpeace International has said time and again that this is not about saving the planet, that this is about saving people, human people. And so we should just take them at their word. And that's what this is about. So all of these bright green technologies are not about saving the planet at all. What they're about is powering industry. So you can see a headline in the LA Times that reads essentially, harming the desert to save the earth. And what that's about is putting in a huge solar power generation facility in the desert. And it is harming the desert, yes. But it's not harming the desert to save the earth, because the earth does not need solar photovoltaic cells. The earth, what it's doing is it's destroying the desert to provide more industrial electricity for industry to use. And this whole book came about because about, 9 years ago now, somewhere in there, I was asked to debate this bright green guy about how humans should move ahead. And I told the people moderating the debate that I only wanted to do this debate in writing, for reasons we'll get to in a second. And they basically wore me down, and eventually I agreed to do it verbally. And so we had a conversation on the phone, and the conversation was dreadful, and I vetoed it ever being published. And the reason it was dreadful was because the bright green was simply lying all through the interview. And that's why I wanted to do it in writing, is so that he could tell a lie and then I could do the proper research to be able to back up, instead of it going, him making an assertion, me saying, oh, that's not true, him saying, yes, it is, me saying, no, it's not, and then we end up calling each other booger faces or something. You know, it's like, instead of it just being a yes, no, I could actually provide facts to support it. And So through the, during that exchange, at one point he was saying something about how 100% metals recycling is possible right now. And I was like, that's just nonsense. And he said, no, it is. And, you know, we basically went down the path ending in booger brain. And so in this book, I talk about how 100% metals recycling is not possible. And it's like copper is very easily recyclable. It's one of the most easily recyclable, metals, but that doesn't alter the fact that first off, we'll get to that in a second, but copper recycling is right now pretty effective. It's like 90% of the copper is recycled or 95 or, you know, I've got the numbers in the book, but I don't remember what they are. It could be 80%, whatever. It's a large amount. But that doesn't alter the fact that copper demand is continuing to rise, which means they're still putting in more copper. So it doesn't matter if you recycle 100% of your copper, you still need copper mines because the economy is still expanding. And right. That's just one example. Now let's go to another example of a way. And so that's, or then there's steel recycling. Steel is often recycled, but steel recycling is an incredibly toxic process requiring very high temperatures and also all sorts of toxic chemicals that, there are toxic waste sites all over the country that were at one point steel recycling sites. And so when he says that they can be recycled, the question always comes back to, and what are the costs? Again, I'm not saying this very well, I want to read something from the book that toward the end of the book, we talk about how we put forward a set of guiding questions or principles by which any bright green technology should be evaluated. And I would like to go through those briefly, and then we can talk about some specifics, like what's wrong with solar photovoltaics, what's wrong with, and then sure, we'll get there in a second. Okay, how you evaluate them. First, there's the technological thing itself, whether it's a photovoltaic cell, a windmill, a battery. What is it? What is it made of? Where do these materials come from? And how are they extracted from the earth? What harms do these extractions cause? Who suffers these harms? What infrastructures are required to support these extractions? What harms are caused by these infrastructures? Who suffers these harms? It's the first sort of set. We're going to go on for a while about this, but I'll stop for a second. Like solar photovoltaics, what are they made of? They require a lot of rare earths. They require so much high quality silicon that there are islands, entire islands, disappearing because they are harvesting all the sand from these islands for photovoltaics. And the most of the rare earths right now are, come from one place in China, Baotou, and that place is completely toxified. Rare earths are not called rare earths because they're so rare, but they're called rare earths because they are, not distributed. You have to go through a lot of ore to get a little bit of the rare earth. And they're actually thinking, I mean, Baotou has been destroyed. We've all heard about, for cell phones, they need coltan and some other materials. And we've all heard about how the mountain gorillas are taking it because of that, that there are wars going on for those. So when we talk about this wonderful green technology, all you have to do is follow the supply chain back. Which they don't do. They talk about them being, it's like people talk about, oh, a solar car is so great, but most of the, we can talk about the batteries too. Those are incredibly toxic, but most of the pollution from a car doesn't emerge from the tailpipe. Most of the pollution from a car comes from the manufacturing process. And they ignore that completely. They say cars have all sorts of other problems too. Cars drive on roads. Roads are real problems for fragmenting the natural world. They don't talk about any of that context.
Right.
So photovoltaics. Oh, another problem with rare earths is there are schemes now that what they want to do is there are tremendous amounts of rare earths at the bottom of the ocean, and they want to mine the bottom of the ocean, which will completely devastate those places they mine.
Well, because Yeah, I mean, in the oceans are already in dire straits already, so it's just like kind of putting the final nail in the coffin.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And people talk, okay, so years ago, and I'm going to come back to my other questions in a second. A few years ago, I got interviewed by this guy. He was a interviewer for Nature Online magazine. That magazine always pisses me off because it's not about nature. It's really one of the most human supremacist pro-technology magazines around. It's really dreadful. Anyway, I've been interviewed by him, I think, three times, and it's been three not good interviews. Anyway, this interview, at one point, the guy says that he is a dedicated Marxist who believes that humans can have an economic system that's based entirely on voluntary exchanges. And he said that they can have a city that way. And I said, okay, great. How do you get around in your city? And he said, well, buses. I said, what are the buses made of? He said, metal. I said, where do you get the metal? He said, mines. I said, how do you get people to work in the mines? He said, you just pay them a lot. And I said, well, yeah, you know, mining is so miserable that it's one of the first forms of slavery. But I'll grant you this. You just pay them a ton and they live their lives underground. Fine. But we also know that mines inherently destroy water. They pollute. And so what do you do about the people who live next to the river? He said, you pay them to move. I said, what happens if they've been living by this river for 5,000 years and they refuse to move? He said, you pay them more. I said, well, if they absolutely refuse because their ancestors are here, this is their home, and they will not move. He said, how many are there? I said, I don't know. What difference does that make? 450. He said, well, the people in the city vote, and there's a million people in the city, and they vote to kick those people off their land so you can have the mine. I said, oh, okay, so what you're saying is within less than a minute, you have gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire and land theft from the indigenous people and genocide, all so you can have a bus. And my point is, that's what we're doing in Bright Green Lies, is we are simply looking at those connections. So it's not simply that you buy a magic photovoltaic cell that the bright green fairies, you know, made out of pixie dust, and when you're done with it, it magically disappears. And same with windmills. There are causes, there are costs to all these. So next paragraph about the questions. And someone simply saying that the materials were recycled does not insulate the technology from being subject to these questions any more than if someone said the materials were derived from pixie dust and unicorn droppings. By what processes and at what costs were the metals removed from the electronics, the impurities removed from the metals? Even ignoring the rest of the planet, as bright greens so often do, who lives in the places from whence you want to extract the materials? Who calls those places home? What will happen to those places? Next, how are the materials transported and converted into their final products? How is iron ore transported and smelted? How is steel fabricated? How is steel transported, melted, turned into pieces to be used in your bright and shiny green windmill? How is the windmill itself assembled and transported? What are the on-site effects of this bright green technology? How many birds will be killed by the solar power generation facility? How many desert tortoises? How many bats? And for what will this bright green technology be used? If it's used to generate electricity, to what purpose? Does this use of the bright green technology help the real world, the physical world, the planet that is the source of all life? Or does it help industry? Those are not the same. And when this piece of technology wears out, what happens to the materials? How toxic are they? What happens to the site? Will it be habitat for sage grouse or hoary bats or whomever used to live there? Is the point of the technology to help the Earth, or is it to maintain this way of living at the expense of the Earth? All of which brings us to Aldo Leopold's wonderful statement, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. That is the measure by which we should judge bright green and other technologies. That is the measure by which we should judge our actions and our lives. So that's in the book. So I want to go back to another of the fundamental lies. Earlier I talked about transportation. And one of the classic bright green lies that we hear is there are all sorts of cities in the United States that are saying that they're going 100% renewable. Well, never mind the fact that renewable isn't really renewable. We can talk about that in a minute. They'll say they're going to use 100, they're going to have 100% renewable energy. And Naomi Klein talks about how Munich is committed to 100% renewable energy by 2025 or something. And we hear this all the time. All these cities are lining up. And it is complete nonsense. It's embarrassing nonsense because they'll say oh, there's this headline. Los Angeles is on the verge of 100% renewable energy. Okay, first, the first lie that's told there is they don't mean energy. They mean electricity. There's a difference. Los Angeles, all the cars in Los Angeles are not going to stop using gas. When they say, okay, electricity is about 20% of energy usage for most metropolises in the world. So when somebody says that Munich is going for 100% renewable energy, what they really mean is 100% renewable electricity, which is 20%. Okay. But 20% doesn't sound quite so exciting, does it? And
no.
You and I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, if I'm talking to my mom, or if you're talking to your mom, or if you're talking to your friend, and you use the word energy instead of electricity, that's no big deal. I'm not being a word fascist here. The problem is that these are professionals who are talking about political issues, and they're saying that they're going to go 100% energy, but that's not true. Do you see what I'm getting at? So Los Angeles is a great example. They say, there's a direct quote, pretty close. Los Angeles is on the verge of 100% renewable energy. Okay, so it's not, they're actually not talking about cars. So let's drop it right now by 80%. So they're actually talking about 20%. Okay. But then you read down the article, and what you find out is that Los Angeles, even in terms of energy, even granting them that solar photovoltaics are, quote, renewable, that's nonsense, but even granting that, says down in the article that they derive about 20% of their electricity from so-called renewable sources. 20% of 20% is 4%. So the headline was Los Angeles on the verge of 100% renewable energy, when the truth is they are using, according to their own definitions, 4% renewable energy. And you see this sort of thing all the time. And they do this. Okay, I'm kind of getting into the details. I'm getting lost in the forest, and I want to step back for a second and say that all of this is a problem because it has affected, well, a couple of things. I guess I want to keep on in this little thicket for a while before I jump out, which is that we don't have time to waste, and these solutions will not work. What they're trying to do is to maintain this culture. They say explicitly, this is about saving civilization. This is not about saving the planet. They say this, but it won't work to save civilization. And I can show that in, three words, long haul freight.
Okay.
You know, basically everything you get has been trucked. And trucks use diesel. The reason trucks use diesel is because it has a high energy intensity, that it has a high energy density, I should say, that for not much weight of diesel, you can drive a long ways. You can have a tank of diesel will drive you 600 miles for a semi.
Right.
And semis have a payload of about 60,000 pounds. To have batteries that would take the truck 600 miles, the batteries would have to weigh about 50,000 pounds, which would leave you about 10,000 pounds payload.
Mm.
It won't work.
Right.
It simply won't work. And almost everything we get at this point has also been transported by ocean. It won't work to transport stuff across the ocean in a big ship using batteries. This is presuming you could generate the electricity in a way that wasn't harmful in the first place, which you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And so my point is that they keep saying we're on the verge of this renewable and they get all excited because they are now having some trucks that are battery powered. A, they don't talk about the horror that is the mining that goes into making those batteries, or how destructive, how toxic batteries are to try to dispose. They don't talk about that, but they get all excited. But then what they don't tell you is that these trucks have a delivery distance have a range of about 60 miles. So it actually works. It effectively works to have a UPS truck that drives around my tiny town that would have batteries. That could actually be doable mm-hmm. because they drive during the day, you know, a total of 80 miles or 60 miles or something. They could do it. But it will not work for long haul trucking. It won't work for any sort of long distance shipping. But they don't say that. So now I want to step back to the larger picture. Here's part of the problem is that there is a terrible coup has taken place, not just among environmentalism, which I said before about how it has been converted from being about protecting the world into protecting this culture that's killing the world. But there's something else that's happened too, which is you can have a million people walk on the streets of Paris or on the streets of New York. And if you ask those individuals, what are you marching for?
Mm-hmm.
They will say, we want to save the planet. But if you ask them, what are your specific demands? Their specific demands are they want more government subsidies for the solar and wind sectors of the industrial economy.
Mm.
It's an extraordinary thing that's taken place, which is that we have a mass movement to save the earth has been developed. And this mass movement has been turned into a lobbying arm of a specific sector of the capitalist economy. That is stunning. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have any number of directions we can go here. We can talk more about specifics on specific bright green lies and what's wrong with what happens with recycling or whatever. Or we can talk about the political effects. We can talk about the psychological effects. I mean, I want to say one more thing before I just, you can ask me whatever the hell you want.
Right.
And the next thing is that I want to say is the key thing here. Okay. Early on in the book, we quote Naomi Klein as saying that I'll see if I can get this exact quote because this is such a quote that gets to the heart of everything. Okay. In her film, This Changes Everything,
mm-hmm.
she states explicitly, quote, I've been to more climate rallies than I can count. But the polar bears, they still don't do it for me. I wish them well, but if there's one thing I've learned, it's that stopping climate change isn't really about them. It's about us.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's, as I mentioned before, the former head of Greenpeace. The struggle has never been about saving the planet. The planet doesn't need saving.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't bear how invisible life on the planet is to these people. And that's the priority and the willful blindness of so much environmentalism. This is the problem right there, is that for members of this culture, the real world doesn't do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. And there is the key to everything, is that if the real world is what does it for you, I just yesterday played an interview that I did maybe a couple weeks ago with a couple of activists in the desert of the deserts of California/Nevada. And they have done a lot of opposition to big solar facilities down there. And they see what it does. Like there's the story they told me about flocks of birds who were landing. See, the solar photovoltaic cells can look like water
mm-hmm.
To birds up in the air, and there are birds who then try to land on this water and they die. Entire flocks. I think there were gannets who cannot take off. They can't take off from land. They're water birds who can only take off from the water, and they land. And those who don't break their legs by landing on this hard surface when they expect water can't take off, and they die in the desert. Or there were all these desert tortoises who were removed from the site, and the desert tortoises tried to make their way back home, and they walked back, and then they came up against the fence, and then just paced back and forth along the fence trying to get home until they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is, but I'm sorry, the desert tortoises don't do it for us. Fuck that.
Yeah.
See, here's the problem, is that we have to make our loyalty to the natural world. Once you make your loyalty to the natural world and not to industrial culture, everything becomes really clear. And this whole con game that is bright green lies just falls apart.
Mm.
Because if your loyalty is to the polar bears, you will choose differently. And you will ask, who is being helped by this technology? I mean, for God's sake, I mentioned before, I'm sorry to go on about this, but I mentioned before that they talk about, I put quotes around the word renewable, and that's because what is considered renewable is biomass. Biomass is a fancy word for saying cutting things up and burning them. And so the forests of the American Southeast are just being devoured by all these pulp mills that they cut the trees, they pulp them, they send them to Europe, and then they burn them for fuel. And this is considered renewable. This is considered carbon neutral, by the way. And I got to tell you this too. This just killed me. This is like the prototypical bright green lie. So biomass, cutting down trees all over the world, burning them, which is what the bright greens are going, oh, this is this wonderful green thing. It's just another excuse to cut forests. Anyway, that is counted as carbon neutral. And the reason they count that as carbon neutral is because if you burn those trees now and all that carbon goes up into the air, then it doesn't matter because over the next 100 years, the trees might grow back. Mm. So it's an accounting trick. Can you imagine any accounting firm in the world that would not get in trouble if they said our books are balanced because we're spending money right now and we hope to make this money back in 100 years?
Mm. Yeah.
Those accountants would be in prison. Yet this is what they call renewable energy. They call dams renewable energy, even though A, dams destroy rivers, of course, and B, dams end up, the energy, the electricity you get from a dam ends up putting more carbon into the air than burning coal. Mm. Because dams are what are called methane bombs. They produce bunches and bunches of methane for reasons we can get into if you want. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the only way that anybody is even remotely – oh, here's another one. There's just so many in through all the book. Germany, they call it the German miracle of because they were lowering their carbon emissions. But what they never tell you is that most of the carbon emissions that they were able to reduce happened between 1990 and 2000, and they were purely through efficiency, making your – more insulation – doing all sorts of things to make your the conversion of energy into work more efficient. And there are limits to how much you can do that. There are absolute limits as to how efficient you can make something. So they gained most of the stuff they could get in those first 10 years. Mm-hmm. And yet this is still described as this positive movement. And the long and short of this is the world doesn't have time for us to fuck around with things that A, are not possible, and B, don't help the world.
Mm, okay. Yeah, so you're kind of just getting to the point. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions, obviously, that, as you pointed out, with all these various examples, misconceptions, lies, and deceptions that have been kind of cultivated in order to benefit certain segment sectors of the industrial economy, which of course is wind energy, solar energy, renewable energies with quotations around renewable. So it's just fascinating that there are, with just that rant that you went on, if you want to call it a rant, but that explanation, you very quickly, I think, peeled back the very obvious lies that we've all, cause like, for me too, I mean, I'm just like, I really hope that we can figure out the renewable energy thing so that life can continue on as I feel comfortable with, that we all feel comfortable having. But that is kind of an extension of the logic of our culture, of our economic system, our monetary system, whatever you want to, get to the root of it, whatever you want to call it. And it's not actually true, because I think that a lot of people are very comfortable just assuming that there's going to be some group of people over here, like whether I've heard a lot of people talk about Elon Musk. He runs SpaceX, he runs Tesla, he's been very forthright about, we need to do something about climate change, we need to do all this stuff. But he is he's one of these guys that's putting out electric cars, these new batteries that are more efficient. He wants to, he has all these projects that he wants to do with infrastructure and transportation. And, it's all like, wow, that seems nice. But then as you have laid out in previous articles, essays, interviews, and what you just said just now, I mean, there's so much that is not being discussed. And I feel like people are being deceived into some kind of complacency because even though the situation that we are in is really dire, we're unable to comprehend that. And we're unable to understand that, that these so-called renewable energies are in fact just, you know, a continuation of the same thing that's been going on for the past few hundred years, you know, using fossil fuels, you know, the sort of extraction that is needed in order to maintain this, economic system. So I guess to kind of go from that, the environmentalism, the environmental movement, you talk about this mass movement of people that are like invested in kind of getting rid of, fossil fuels and moving in a,
which is not happening, by the way.
Right. Right. And so I want to know, like, in your opinion or from what you can understand, when did that shift happen? Because was it like you had said, I think you had an article you had written about, I don't know how to say this, it was like fighting for the heart and soul of the environmentalist movement. And you had this kind of plea, not a plea, but kind of this idea that like this movement has been hijacked by industrialists and these people that are in these huge marches, and you go and ask them, like you said, you know, what are you fighting for? You want to save the planet? Well, then how are you going to do that? Well, we want to basically demand that our governments give subsidies to these, you know, the wind and solar industry, these renewable energy companies. You know, where did that happen? You know, at what point? Was it a slow transition, or did it just sort of happen? Like, where did that coup happen? Where did that take place?
Well, I would like to say that a lot of it took place in the 1990s, but I have to, there is something that I sort of glossed over. Whenever I say this, I put a little asterisk in my mind that I'm so glad you brought this up right now, because mm-hmm. because I want to be explicit with this asterisk, which I usually just keep in my mind, mm-hmm. which is, it's not merely the last 30 years that have been problematical, although they've been much worse. This is a conflict that goes further back, and it's a conflict that was between Gifford Pinchot and John Muir, where John Muir believed that the world should be preserved for its own sake, because the world deserves to live for its own sake, and the world is not here for us to use. And Gifford Pinchot, who was all about wise use, that you maintain these resources, you perceive the world as resources, and you use them wisely and make sure that they stick around forever. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that Gifford Pinchot would be having a heart attack at how bad things have become, because when he was around, there was still something of a planet. And so it's not merely that these bad people have taken over in the last 30 years. This is a conflict that's been going on for a long time. So I need to put that asterisk in.
Okay.
But having said that, it's really accelerated over the last 30 years. And I think part of the reason it's accelerated, there are a bunch of reasons. One is because people have become more narcissistic, and this is certainly a more narcissistic attitude. And there are studies that show that college students, they did a study from 1990 through 2010 asking college students questions like, if you have a sandwich and your friend is hungry, will you give your friend some? And so they were able to figure out that empathy over the last 25 years has been dropping dramatically. Mm. And that doesn't come as a surprise to really anybody who's paying any attention, that the narcissism in this culture is getting worse. Postmodernism adds to that. You know, we can talk about all those things too. But another thing that's happening is this is the end of empire. And I want to, you know, I used to be a beekeeper, and I would pay very close attention to the seasons, because, you know, all farmers do. And what I learned pretty quickly was that beehives who might be very nice and happy in June and July, come September and October, get really cranky, get in September especially, because fall is coming, the sources of nectar and pollen are stopping, and they're getting desperate for the winter. I've seen this with bears. The bears who can be perfectly happy in June can get pretty mad in October. Wasps get pretty nasty. It's when things start to shut down. Mm. Okay, here's another way to say this. That one of the my favorite parts of Culture Make-Believe, what the book, was where I realized, I asked, why is it that there were more lynchings after the American Civil War than before? And I couldn't thought about this for a couple weeks. And then it came to me through a quote by Nietzsche, one does not hate when one can despise. And suddenly I understood. And what I understood was that so long as your ability to exploit is not threatened, everything from the perspective of those who are doing the exploiting, everything is groovy. Mm-hmm. But as soon as that perceived entitlement to exploit is threatened, whether it's through the end of chattel slavery at the end of the American Civil War, or whether it's through any other means, then you will, the contempt that you felt for those you exploit before turns over into outright hatred. Or another way to put this in the modern terms is, as long as everything was going along swimmingly with capitalism and empire, then environmentalism could exist, and the notion of a few people here saying, no, don't kill everything because we want to save some little scraps, you could accept those as basically minor nuisances. But we have all known all along that when push comes to shove, what is important to this culture is the continuation of this culture and not life on the planet. And that as soon as capitalism, civilization, those in power, whatever you want to call them, as soon as they need those resources that were previously protected, they're going to go after them. Mm-hmm. But naked theft is not by itself very congenial. And so what they need is they need to rationalize this behavior, and they need to come up with, Robert J. Lifton talked about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is actually good. You have to have a claim to virtue in order to destroy this thing. So the Nazis, in their own perspective, were not murdering Jews and committing mass murder and genocide. They weren't committing land theft. They were purifying the Aryan race and taking their Lebensraum from their own perspective. Of course, what they're really doing is mass murder and genocide.
Yeah.
And likewise with the Americans, you know, we had manifest destiny instead of land theft and genocide. And nowadays, of course, there's developing natural resources, and the latest claim to virtue that allows this culture to destroy the planet is we need to protect ourselves from global warming. That's why we need to pour all this money. This is one thing that kills me about Naomi Klein, is that she was so brilliant with writing Shock Doctrine about how the capitalists will, use a disaster in order to increase their stranglehold. But that's exactly what the bright greens are doing, is they are using global warming, the catastrophe that is global warming, in order to further the ends of capital. It's stunning to me.
Right.
Anyway, my point is that one of the reasons that environmentalism has been turned, so much of the mainstream environmentalism has been turned, is because we are at the end of civilization. There are no more planets to exploit, and so they need to ravage even the areas that were left unravaged before. And in order to do that, they need to not merely nakedly take them, which they will do if they need to, but if they can develop a movement that is co-opted into supporting that, they will certainly do that too. That's one reason it's really exploded this direction over the last 25 years. Mm. Does that make sense? Am I being clear at all?
Yeah. No, you totally are. Absolutely. You know, that just, when you were talking about that, it reminds me a bit of how there's been recent decisions from the Trump administration to open up certain national parks that have been protected under the federal government, right? Department of Interior, but now they're being opened up for, I guess, to be sold, to be privatized, to be used for whatever purposes, I guess, if whoever buys them wants to do with them. And I think there was something recently written into the tax bill about, I think it was ANWR, I believe, up in Alaska for exploration for fossil fuels, I think, if I remember correctly. But there's so many things happening now. We're getting kind of, you know, I'm talking about Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, and I feel like that's sort of what was happening now. It seems like things are getting more and more, it's like people are getting bombarded on from multiple angles, multiple levels, and it's really hard to keep up with it. So on the, environmental level, we're seeing, kind of mass privatization of lands that were once protected under federal government regulation. But on civil rights as well. But, oh, sorry, go on.
Well, okay, so when I went to college, I got a degree in physics, mm-hmm. and then I had a year left of eligibility for high jumping. So I went back to graduate school for a year, and what I took, because it was, I was kind of sick of science, what I took was the easiest thing they offered there, which was mineral economics. And the difference between economics and mineral economics is that mineral economics is, will teach you how to deal with something that is a finite resource. Like most of the economic rules, if they talk about, you know, buying tires or paper clips, the presumption is there's an infinite number of paper clips. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they run out, they can just make more. But mineral economics is based on you have some gold in the ground, and how do you economically decide which gold to get? And I can break it down into a very simple thing. This is sort of the heart of mineral economics, is that you take out the stuff first that's the easiest to get to. Mm-hmm. Pretty straightforward.
Right.
I mean, think about this. You got, like, name any food you like. I don't care what.
Pickles.
Pickle. Okay. So you have a jar of pickles on your counter. You have another jar of pickles that is a mile away, and you have another jar of pickles that is 2 miles away and is guarded by heavily armed people. Mm-hmm. Which pickles are you going to eat first?
The ones that are closest. You're going to eat closest. Yeah.
Exactly. The ones that you can get easily. And then after you eat the first two sets, it's like, now I need to figure out how to get past the armed guard, eat those pickles. And so what we're seeing here with all the stuff you're talking about is national parks, wilderness, all that. They were mainly, not exclusively, but mainly rocks and ice. They were the places that were not desirable. The most desirable places are generally the places by rivers, which is where we have cities, mm-hmm. which is, those are the places that were cut first. Mm-hmm. And now that they've gone through the pickles on the shelf and they've gone through the pickles that were 2 miles away, now they're going through the pickles that were in the National Pickle Reserve. Mm-hmm. You know, these pickles were preserved for posterity, but we've gone through the others and now it's time. I mean, this is as predictable. Sorry to use a terrible cliche, but it's as predictable as clockwork.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is a pattern that I think people have studied for a long time in their own way. It's not that it shouldn't be that surprising, but of course it's still appalling. And I think that's what, for me, I think the difference between being surprised about what's happening versus being appalled, there is something of maybe a thin line between those two feelings, because I don't know. I guess for me, I get kind of comfortable and I'm just sort of going along with my life, not really taking in what I know intellectually. I don't necessarily feel it on an emotional level. But there are those stories and there are those things that come along that break through that. And I'm always like kind of, I'm almost surprised at my surprise, you know, like, well, why am I surprised? Of course this is going to happen. So,
I totally get that.
You understand that? Yeah.
I feel it myself. It's like, I've been working on these issues for decades and it still is like, Derek, why are you surprised that this culture lies? Why are you surprised that they come up with a means to propagate all these bright green lies? They lie about everything. Why does this surprise you?
Mm-hmm.
And so I get sort of surprised at my constant surprise.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there's definitely a spectrum of human nature, but I think there's a part of us that kind of, once we understand that it doesn't make sense to cut everything out from under us, right? It doesn't make sense in the long term, but that's exactly what's happening. And so and I think that's the thing I like to talk about on this podcast, is sort of remarking on the absurdity of these times. And, you know, there have been plenty of absurd times throughout human history. The existence of human beings have definitely done this multiple times, but I think that we're at a particular phase in our existence where, we've never been more, like, information has never been able to be, transferred instantaneously like it is now. So we can kind of recognize what's happening globally versus maybe what's happening more locally, right? And
this is assuming that people make decisions based on information.
Right.
Which I'm.
Yeah, no, and they don't, but you can at least be aware of it. And, not that that necessarily makes people act or do anything about it, but I feel like that's why I think people are kind of paralyzed and they're sort of in the state of shock because it's happening on multiple levels and multiple angles. I don't know. It's interesting to have political arguments with people and sort of discuss these issues. But my question to you, I guess, is so if sustainable energy is not sustainable and, you know, the fossil fuel industry is going to continue to exist in some capacity or another, and we're going to continue to toxicify our environments and.
Oh, I want to say something about that too.
Yeah.
So there is something else that is very rarely brought up in discussions of so-called renewable energy, which is Jevons paradox. Do you know Jevons paradox?
I don't.
It's great. Well, it's terrible. It's
like, okay.
It's very interesting, which is Jevons was this economist who in the 1830s, 1850s, I don't know, some back long time ago, and he's dead now. He was an economist who figured out that when they made coal more, when they made more efficient ways to use coal, it did not decrease coal usage as you would expect.
Mm.
So if they find out that you can cook your dinner using less coal, that should make it so there is less coal used, right?
Right.
The problem is that decreasing the cost actually increased the usage because people found more uses for it.
Mm. Right.
And this is especially true for industry, which uses most of the energy. And a great way to think about this is, and a way I write about it in the book, is I live in Northern California, and most of Northern California is, the economy is based on marijuana, some of which is grown indoors. And let's say you have an indoor marijuana grow that is costing you $1,000 a month in electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So then suddenly the energy becomes much more efficient. So that you can, and you're making, let's say, $3,000 a month. I'm making all these numbers up.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making $3,000 a month profit, and all of a sudden energy drops to half as much. So either A, you can now make $3,500 a month in profit because you've dropped $500 in cost, or you can double the size of your grow and make, still pay $1,000 in electricity, but now you're making $6,000 a month.
Mm. Yeah.
And from the perspective of the capitalist, no question, which you do, because the point of capitalism is to grow. This is not about maintaining. It doesn't matter what an individual does for their own family. What's important is what the capitalists will do, driven by their growth imperative. And so my example is clear, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So this is what happens. So what happens is as they bring this electricity online, through for solar or whatever, it is not, in fact, for the most part, replacing the oil. What it is doing is adding to it. For God's sake, we've all heard of Bitcoin, right? At this point, everybody who does not live under a rock has heard of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is using, like, I don't know how much, like, just gigawatt after gigawatt of energy, and it didn't exist 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
12 years ago, however long ago.
Yeah.
And this is a completely new use of electricity. So this is that was not there 12 years ago. So no matter what we do, I mean, when you have a growth economy and increasingly energy usage intensive economy, it's ridiculous to talk about phasing out fossil fuels. What's going to happen is that oil is going to continue to get used, and these other are going to just add on to the top,
yeah.
Which is exactly what's happening.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So it's
again, it doesn't help. This doesn't help the natural world. This does not. That's the question I always come back to: is does this help coho salmon? Does this help black-throated sparrows?
Right.
Does it help desert tortoises?
Mm. Right. And so. This is something that I think about is what is the appropriate response to all of this, and by that I mean, if the so-called savior that is renewable energy isn't in fact saving anybody, isn't going to save civilization, and it's definitely not going to, you know, have any real positive impact on the other life forms on this planet. So then, what do people do? I guess, what is the appropriate reaction? What action can people take to just fight for it, right? You know, because if you know all this stuff, you know, you can go to bed at night and you can pretend like everything's fine. Because I think at least I do. I live in somewhat of a, I want to say it's 100% comfortable, but I'm oblivious in my day-to-day life of the reality of this, but I know that it's happening. So like, what do people do? I mean, I don't want to be complacent, you know? I don't want to, I don't know. I like doing this podcast and talking to people like you about this, but I feel like a lot of times I catch myself kind of just, it's just, I don't know, what is the word? It's a little self-indulgent to just talk about these things and to just think that I'm doing something special. You know, I don't know what the appropriate action is. And I guess that's why, if you have any insight, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I think about this.
That's why I wrote one of the lines that has become one of the lines I'm known for, which is, every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because I recognize that words are important, but words are not what's killing the planet. So I do want to say that I think your work is important. And I think that it's like a doctor friend of mine says, correct diagnosis is the first step toward proper treatment. And if you have the wrong diagnosis, you're going to make actions that are, your treatment is going to be incorrect, which is precisely what we see with the Bright Green Lies group. Mm. And so I think the first thing we need to do is to tell the truth, and to tell the truth as honestly and as often as we can. So I think that you're doing a great service with that. And I think we also need to recognize that while these words may be necessary, they're not sufficient.
Right.
And so I think, I mean, I always go back to something that so many indigenous people have said to me, is the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that says to me is to change our allegiance and our loyalty away from the dominant culture and to the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason all through this book we keep hammering that notion of polar bears just don't do it for me. It's not to be snarky. It's because that is the central problem, is that, honestly, frogs do it for me, and salmon do it for me, and cedar trees do it for me, and redwood trees do it for me. And, oh, my God, now I'm listing, which means I have to list everybody or somebody's going to feel bad. You get the idea, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we keep hammering that because that's the central part. So I think the first thing that I really want people to do is to make your loyalty to the natural world. And then once you make your loyalty to the natural world, then you start to defend it in some way. And, I mean, you can defend it first, too. But in any case, what's important is for – I think there's two different stages that are both very important. One is to defend every wild place and every wild being, because it's like an environmentalist friend of mine, John Osborne, often says that the reason he does what he does is because he wants – as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. What he means by that is, if bull trout are still around in 20 years, they may still be around in 100. If they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. So it's sort of a not on my watch attitude, that they will not go down on my watch. That will not happen. Mm. I will do whatever it takes to protect them. So that's the first thing, is to defend wild places and wild beings. And the other thing is, you know, I've used this image for years and I really mean it. And it's that if space aliens had come down from outer space and they were killing the oceans, and they were deforesting the planet, and they were putting endocrine disruptors in every mother's breast milk on the planet, and they were changing the climate, and they were quite possibly going to make this planet uninhabitable, what would we do If they were space aliens, what would we do? Suddenly, if they're space aliens, it becomes really, really easy because we recognize what you do. Oh, I'm going to back up for a second. And I did a talk. I mean, I didn't do a talk. I was asked to attend a board meeting at Patagonia, the company, last year.
Oh, yeah.
And it was delightful. I just have to say, yes, they're capitalist. Yes, everything in this culture is horrible. And they recognize that, too. But Patagonia and the Tompkins have done – Yvonne Chouinard and the Tompkins have done more good environmental work than I think any other environmentalists in the world in the last 25 years. And Patagonia, I mean, they are – they're a company. They're a pretty big company. And they are, if you can believe I'm saying this, fantastic. They fund great things. They recognize it's all really good.
Right.
Anyway, so we're sitting there talking all day, and I felt like I was coming home when I was there. It's just it was so nice to talk to all these people who are biocentric, and they're still operating in this culture as we all do, but they're doing it recognizing that the culture is unsustainable, recognizing that they got to do whatever they can to protect wild places. It was all great. Anyway, so last thing of the day is Yvonne Chouinard turns to me. He's the head of Patagonia, founder of Patagonia. He turns to me and he says, and he was saying this rhetorically, he wasn't actually going to do it. He said, if I gave you $20 million right now, what would you do with it? And without hesitation, I said, I would use it to build a militant resistance movement that was aimed at taking down industrial infrastructure. And it was so funny because our corporate lawyer immediately said, we are not having this conversation.
Yeah.
And then we had the conversation. And it was great. And we they're not going to fund that. That's which is perfectly fine. I wasn't expecting them to. But my point is, we all understand, those of us who understand that war has been declared against the natural world, recognize that the way you win war is by depriving the enemy of their ability to wage war. World War II was won, A, yes, by the Russian army, and B, by the Russian winter, and C, it was also won by the Allied bombing forces destroying the German capacity to wage war.
Mm.
And what I'm trying to get at is that what I want for people to recognize is that war is being declared on the natural world that really doesn't do it for people in this culture. And that if they were space aliens, we would know exactly what to do.
Mm. Yeah. I guess there's something about the familiarity of having human beings with, you know, within human institutions enact these,
well,
you know.
It's fine. If it was nasty commie Russian pinkos who were doing it, we would still have – the problem is that we have been inculcated into identifying with the system and identifying with the culture. We have been inculcated into caring more about the continuation of civilization. Even environmentalists, this brings us back to the beginning of the talk, of the interview, that even environmentalists, a lot of them, have been inculcated into trying to protect, like the head of Greenpeace said, making this about people, by which he really means industry, and not about the natural world. And we need to reverse that. And we need to break all of that several thousand years of training of humans being the only ones who are worth living, whose existence is worth anything. And especially industrial humans are the only ones whose existence is worth anything. We need to reverse that. And we need to recognize that these others. I mean, here's the thing too, that's really important, which is that there is no surplus in nature. There is none.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, by which I mean everybody and everybody, is someone's food.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take it, somebody else doesn't get to take it. And that's fine. We all, you know, one bear eats a salmon, another bear can't eat that salmon. That's fine. And there were enough salmon that they could eat the hearts and the organs and throw the rest away. Those bodies would then be eaten by eagles or whatever. But everybody ate some. And when we take it all, then there is nothing left for others to eat. It's no surprise that the world is collapsing because we are taking everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we either need to stop that, understand a reasonable system. We're not talking about just, you know, we can have a reasoned discussion, and things will turn out okay. What we're talking about is a psychopathic culture, and we're talking about an addicted culture.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a bunch of addicts who are addicted to, who are so addicted to their electronic goodies that they will kill the planet rather than stop their use.
Right. Well, I almost wonder if there's, because you know, you talk about the addiction that we all have to our electronic goodies, and I feel like there's so many things that that make it very difficult for people to look at the system the way that you just laid out, right? And that it's going to take some, that there's going to have to be some, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. It's almost like Mother Nature, you know, the forces that we have unleashed on the planet, climate change, whatever it is, that itself is going to have to shut down elements of our civilization, shut down industry through natural disasters, whatever, for any of this to actually happen. And then by that point, by the time that that's, I mean, it's already starting to happen in many places, but for that to start to happen more and more means that it's already too late. Cause I don't know if I see people, you know, I believe it's great that people want to do that, that they want to actually resist and organize and commit, acts of direct, you know, direct action to stop this horrible catastrophe from unfolding. But it's almost like the work has to be done. Like there has to be certain things that have to happen before that is even possible. And maybe I'm wrong in that. I just feel like there has to be certain things that need to occur, in order for people to really wake up. And maybe not. Maybe that won't happen, because I think as catastrophes unfold, human beings are capable of kind of going to the extremes. I mean, I actually had a woman that I was talking to. So I live in Twin Falls, Idaho, and we have a refugee program at the local, the community college. So we have people from all over the world that have escaped war torn areas. There was a woman I was talking to named Samra Kolum, and she's a Bosnian. She was a refugee. She left when she was a child from Bosnia. And, you know, having her tell her story about what happens when war is visited to your community, what happens when the things that you thought were normal and the sort of cohesive community that you thought you were a part of, it begins to fall apart. And she said there are extremes. Like she says, obviously there's the horrible things that I kind of remember, which is the snipers, the violence, the people in my community being assassinated and executed and murdered, and the horrible things that were happening around her. But she says also that as they were trying to escape the country, there was just these people that just opened their homes to them and said, you know, come in, you know, we will provide everything we can for you to get out of this situation. So within these moments of extreme peril, the capacity for, you know, openness and love is just as possible as the opposite of that, which of course is, you know, as we see with the Bosnian War, any other war that's happened. And you're mentioning actually before the interview, how colonialism affected Africa and how there was these indirect, I can't remember how you described it.
Indirect rule
that was imposed by colonial forces. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is that my feeling is that it's going to have to get worse before any sort of active change occurs on any mass level within human society. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's sort of how I feel about it.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree at all. And we, that's one reason that you and I do our work now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, that's why people practice in sports.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you want, and that's why the military trains, is that you want to work through these questions of loyalty the best you can in before it's necessary for you to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, of course, one can make wonderful decisions when one is not prepared before, but when one has prepared, I mean, it helps to prepare the ground, and it helps. I mean, it's no coincidence that know, the IRA really developed in Ireland in the early 20th century. And it's no coincidence that in the late 19th century, they had the Gaelic literature revival. Mm. And they had to go through a time of breaking their identification as British and returning to their identification as Gaelic. And that helped to, like, the movie, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, it's a really good movie. And it starts with all these Irish guys out, curling, doing this Irish sport, mm-hmm. Gaelic sport. And it's like, why did they start with that? But the reason they started with that is because that was part of that transformation. We're not going to do British sports. We're going to do Gaelic sports and we will learn to work together. And it's very interesting that the IRA developed out of the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which developed out of the Gaelic Youth Sports League or something like that.
Right.
And so my point is that, we need to prepare the ground through things like the interviews you do. And that is an absolute, I think, necessary step mm-hmm. toward any sort of transformation.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that you, I mean, for me, I mean, you've been doing this much longer than I have and you've been writing. And I think when I was coming into my own, political consciousness, whatever that is in, you know, my teenage years, started to read and understand these subjects a little more in depth. I mean, your name popped up multiple times. So I think you've laid the groundwork for me in some ways and for others and countless other people. And so I think that your work is incredibly important in that regard.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I think your, I've heard interviews with, that you've had with people and you mentioned a few of them, or at least one or two in this conversation, but you've made such valid points that I think people really do begin to question their underlying assumptions about activism itself and what you're supposed to do with your time as an activist, right? And I think that's important. I think people need to always question their tactics, question what they need to do. I think that you've opened up a lot of that conversation. So I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Derek, I know that I don't know what your plans are for right now, regarding this book, Bright Green Lies. If you could let me know and let listeners know, when we can expect this book to come out. And I also like to know who you're collaborating with. I think it was Max Wilbert, I believe that was, I initially heard about it. But are you working with Max Wilbert on this book as well?
Yes.
Okay.
And Max and then also Lear Keith.
Okay.
And we'll be done in 3 or 4 months probably. And then usually takes about a year for books to come out. So I would expect it fall of 2019.
Okay.
And we need it before that, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that'll be great. Do you have any other upcoming projects? Any more books that are coming out in the near future?
Yeah, I've got a book, that's in the can that's, coming out this fall that is about, basically a war for the soul of anarchism. Mm. And it's about the conflict between those who understand that governments exist primarily to serve the wealthy, you know, that they make laws that basically serve them. Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty basic and common understanding. You know, if I used to ask people at talks if they believe that the government took better care of individual human beings or of corporations. And everybody laughs, of course, because like nobody, seriously, nobody out of tens of thousands of people ever said the government takes better care of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's a conflict between the people who understand that, the governments exist by and for the wealthy on one hand. And on the other hand, you have people who believe that because governments exist by and for the wealthy or the powerful, that means that all social restrictions must be removed. Mm-hmm. So I have ad anarchists get really, really mad at me because I say I don't have a problem with laws against rape.
Mm-hmm.
And there are anarchists like Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed, that has come out strongly in favor of pedophilia.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
And this is not some tiny little weird subgroup. This is, queer theory is closely related to anarchism, and the main queer theorists have, whether this is Michel Foucault or Judith Butler, Gail Rubin, have all come out either in favor of or using coded language in favor of adult child incest. And the way I respond to that, I talk about this extensively in the book, and the way I respond to that is, it doesn't matter if you're in Nazi Germany. That is no reason to rape a child.
Mm. Yeah.
So the point is, between these, what I call the sane anarchists, who have this political analysis and who understand that, who understand the governments are inherently oppressive, and we need to figure out how we're going to live given that, and how we're going to respond politically to that. Kropotkin, I would put in that category. And there are a fair number of really decent anarchists who are like that. And then on the other hand, you have basically, if you have a political ideology that is based on the notion of freedom, it will, of course, attract sociopaths who are primarily interested in their own personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I say is, for God's sake, you've got Jesus talking about peace, and you have Christians. There are people who become Christians in order to satisfy their own power needs and to use it to promote their own power, male power over women, what have you.
Right.
And likewise, there are certainly police who join the police so they can abuse other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly psychotherapists who become psychotherapists because they have control issues and they want to control people.
Mm-hmm.
All true. So you would think that anarchism would do a little bit of self-analysis on this to ask, what percentage of anarchists have become anarchists because they're sociopaths.
Mm.
And I was talking to a really good anarchist about this and saying, what are some of the problems of anarchism? And he said, one of the problems of anarchism is that it's a self-description. Anybody who decides they're an anarchist can call themselves an anarchist, and there's no way to kick them out. And if you try to get them to behave, then they call you a fascist and worse.
Right.
And so this is a huge problem in anarchism. And what I say in the book is that basically, we're in a race. I'm going to see if I can find this real quick, because this is a nice quote. It's one of my favorite quotes from that book.
Okay.
Should take me less than 20 seconds to find it.
That's fine.
Let's go here. Let's go. Doop. Okay, 30 seconds. Okay, the book is open. I have to do a search for... Oh, I found it right away. Okay, good. As it becomes increasingly obvious that capitalism, indeed industrialism, indeed civilization, is killing the planet, and as it becomes increasingly clear that these systems are and always have been based on the exploitation of the poor by the rich, those of us who care about life on the planet and those of us who care about justice and fairness will increasingly search not only for ways to stop this culture and its atrocities and injustices, but for saner, more ecologically healthy and appropriate, more just ways to live and to organize our societies. As capitalism, industrialism, and civilization reach their end games, as consolidating state and corporate power and the technological capacity to surveil and control at a distance compete with the ongoing unraveling of the global economy and, far more importantly, complete ecological collapse, in a race to see precisely what sort of short-term dystopian future unfolds and what sort of longer-term, more sane, one hopes, futures might in time emerge from or supplant this dystopia, more and more people will be asking themselves what roles, if any, anarchism has to play in the future. This makes it all the more important to ask, what is anarchism? What is it in theory, and how does it play out in the real world, everywhere from the body politic of the body of Earth to the bodies of women and children? Right now, honestly, anarchism among especially the crazy anarchists, anarchism is a hotbed of misogyny. It is scarily woman hating.
Really?
And so we need to deal with that. So that's what that book's about.
Okay.
And that's coming out this fall.
Okay. Yeah, I when I was contacting you again for a second time, the issue surrounding, you know, sustainable energy was the thing that really stuck out to me, but that's a whole other rabbit hole that we could go down. but maybe I'll contact you again and when that book comes out and we can talk about that. That would be really great. Derek, I know that you have your website. I think that is derekjensen.com. Is that right?
Nope, .org.
.org, excuse me, .org. And I'll provide a link to that in the description of this episode so people can become more familiar with your work, which is, there's a lot of it and there's a lot of resources that people can find at that website. Derek, I thank you for your time and for your thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Your questions are great.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week. And as the psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.